So, welcome back.
Das war mein erster Spielfilm, den ich mit 24 Jahren.
By the way, I'm really glad that this DVD edition exists. It came out last year or in 2010, I think. The Goethe Institute, the German Institute, issued a huge DVD box with Herzog's documentary films, and that's so good because, as you might have seen, they have subtitles in about 10 different languages or so, and because if not, it's quite difficult to show them to foreign audiences. And so, I've been talking about Herzog and the archive Herzog and found footage without actually knowing if you know Werner Herzog at all as a filmmaker. So I just wanted to start this part of the lecture, which will be about his career and the reception of his films, by asking you, before coming here, did you ever see a film of Werner Herzog, or did anybody ever see a film of Werner Herzog? Which film?
Nosferatu.
Someone else? Sorry? Bad Lieutenant. Okay, yeah. You all? You too? No?
Yes, Lesson of Darkness, for example.
Okay.
It's a film about nothing and it's very impressive.
We are going to see a part of that film tomorrow. Yeah, I will talk about it tomorrow. I don't know if it's a film about nothing, but it's impressive. That's true. okay, so what is so interesting about Herzog is, he knows very well, and I don't know if he only, because since 20 years he lives in California, first in San Francisco and then now in Los Angeles, and I don't know if it's only because he lives in Los Angeles now that he knows how to sell himself. I think maybe he knew that already before. But it's obvious that he, although he may seem to be shy sometimes, he's not, let's say, a classical television person or so, but he knows very well what to say about himself and about his films. And there's one typical thing about him. These are anecdotes, or better, maybe myths about his own life. And if you have read, I have copied you for preparing this lecture, I've copied you the first chapter of this interview book I've been talking about by Paul Cronin. And in this first chapter, if you've read it, he talks a lot about his youth and about his first steps to become a filmmaker. And already this first chapter is full of myths about his person that he has repeated many times. And that he almost every time that he gets interviewed will repeat again and again. And I just remind you of some things like, it's always, when I was 11, I saw my first two films. When I was 12, I ate my first banana. When I was 14, I had two dramatic weeks. Yeah, I began to travel on foot. And I converted to the Catholic faith, And I quote, I wanted to go to Albania, that mysterious country which was completely closed off to the rest of the world at that time. But they would not let me in, so I walked as far as the Adriatic, keeping close to the Albanian-Yugoslavian frontier all the time, maybe 50 meters at most. I never dared enter Albania, though. It was my first real escape from home life at 14. He walked to Albania. So, with then the next thing. I did not make my first telephone call until I was 17. And his first phone calls then at the age of 17 were to producers because he had already written a script and wanted to get this script produced as a film. And then after these phone calls, he showed up to meet them. And when they saw how young he was, they laughed at him and he ran away. And he knew from that moment on, I knew that I had to produce myself. The films myself and so on. Yeah, these are the muse that he keeps repeating and repeating. And when I met his brother once, who is, as I've said, his kind of personal manager, he told me, yeah, you have to be careful about these stories of my brother because they are all made up. It's all a lie. And he said to me what I didn't know, for example, that when he was younger, Herzog, so at the beginning of his career, he very often claimed that he was a descendant of a gypsy family. But then his own family complained and he had to stop pretending that. I mean, okay, this is one thing, telling anecdotes and making a myth of your life, but in the case of Herzog, one has to know that this is a strategy that has also a particular reason, and the reason is that in the 1970s, so in his early career, he was fiercely attacked in Germany, and I will talk about the details later. He was there were a lot of reproaches that he would abuse many, many people in order to make his films. And I mean, the culmination of these reproaches was the filming of Fitzcarraldo, his probably best-known film, because the shooting took 3 years in the jungle in Peru and South America and so on. And there were a lot of accidents, for example, related to the film, but he was not responsible for them. But actually, people also died in accidents. And then there was the question of the indigenous people and so on and so on. I will talk about that a little bit later. But at this time, I think he learned that because the Boulevard press started to get interested into his personality and attacked him. And so up. And of course, many or other filmmakers, for example, who were not very well known, and they envied him maybe, and they tried to get famous by accusing Herzog, for example, then they could get into the press themselves. And so many people around him also started to lie and to invent stories about him. And at that time, he later told, he learned that the only chance you have if you get so fiercely attacked by people and they invent lies about you is you have to invent even bigger lies. Yeah. And that became kind of his strategy, I think. So in the example of Fitzcarraldo, for example, he had his female star of the film was Claudia Cardinale, huge European star at the time. And at some point, you know, the press, there was this colportation that Claudia Cardinale had an accident during the shooting, which was not true. And so when this rumor came up, Herzog just said in an interview, oh yeah, she had a fiercely accident, but you know what, that was not all, she was also raped. And so this maybe the most important example where you can study his myths or his lies as a strategy. And of course, it's also an important strategy to build a border between you and your private life, maybe, and your public life. And it's maybe also some idea of being an artist that you have to have a rich life of anecdotal life, a life with interesting stories to tell. And if you don't have these interesting stories to tell, maybe you have to invent them or make them a little bit more interesting than they really were. But as we will see, another thing that is behind all this myth-telling by Herzog is his notion of ecstatic truth, which is a very important concept for him, which he repeats all the time. And also the book I've been referring to by Brett Prager about him is also called The Ecstatic Truth of Werner Herzog and so on. And one idea of this concept, of course, is that the facts of life are not similar to the truth of life. Yeah, just by telling the facts of your life, you don't tell the truth about you. Sometimes you have to, if a lie about your life can be closer to the truth than the fact. You know, it's like if you want to explain something, maybe sometimes it's easier to explain a certain point if you make up something which is a good image of the point that you want to make than to tell a fact, because with that fact nobody gets the real idea behind it. So this is also a reason for his habit to tell a lot of myths. By the way, one other myth may be the one about his name, Werner Herzog, because Werner Herzog, if you pronounce it in the German way, because he keeps, I told you, his brother has a different name. His brother's name is Luki Stipetic. And Stipetic was the maiden name of the mother. They are half brothers, so his brother Luki Stipetic has a different father, and he has the maiden name of the mother. And Herzog often says that, because it's also a very nice anecdote, that his original name was Werner Stipetic, and that only when he chose to become a filmmaker, he chose the name Herzog of his father, who was divorced from his mother. He chose the name Herzog because Herzog means duke. And he then used to say, okay, you know, jazz music has his Duke Ellington and a count, the Count Basie. And so German filmmaking now also needs a duke, and that will be me. And so my name will be Werner Herzog. And so this is his story. But his brother told me, in fact, this is absolutely not true, because his name was never Stipetic. He is from the start to the end, his name was Herzog. So anyway, this is typical maybe for his public personality, at least. And what I now want to do is I'm presenting you a text that is part of a talk that I've been given at an American conference, and it explains a little bit about his context of being a Bavarian, because for him that is very important, for not only for his person but also for his films. He always claims that his films are Bavarian films. So Bavaria is a region in Germany, in the south of Germany, like Bohemia, for example, in Czech Republic. And and he was born in Munich, which is the capital of Bavaria, and raised in at the countryside. And then later, at I think the age of 14 or something, he went back to Munich, and that's where he started his career. And I will start this by showing you a very short clip of an interview, I think in 2008 in New York, and Jonathan Demme, the filmmaker who made Silence of the Lambs, for example, he made a public interview with Herzog that lasts for about 1 hour, and I show you only a small portion of that.
Werner, you were born in Germany.
In Bavaria. In Bavaria.
Yeah, which I would like to.
Okay.
I'd like to make that distinction.
That's a, no, I'm fair enough. Is that a Scots, is that
a Scotsman? A Scotsman would not agree easily that he was British. I don't like the Germans.
And that's not the only occasion when he said something like this. So Werner Herzog's declarations in this interview conducted by Jonathan Demme on the 10th of June 2008 in New York do not lack clearness. I was born in Bavaria and I don't like the Germans. Whereas being born in Bavaria is indeed a fact of his life, Herzog, quite typically for him, fails to clarify the reasons for his animosity towards his fellow countrymen, the Germans. Thus, I want to explore the roots of Herzog's inconsistent relationship to his homeland and the consequences of his Bavarian origins for his oeuvre. Although born in the Bavarian capital Munich, Herzog grew up close to the border with Austria, in a, especially at that time, the 1940s and early 1950s, a very remote village called Sachrang. The occasions are numerous in which he tells anecdotes of his childhood after the war, when the boys, in the absence of their fathers, as well as in the absence of mass media like telephone, television or cinema, played with real weapons that had been thrown away by escaping German soldiers. The circumstances of these first 11 years of his life in the mountainous and densely wooded landscape of Upper Bavaria, surrounded by a mythical, magical, as well as a rural, earthy culture, helped him to gain the intellectual and spiritual independence that is not only fairly visible in his personality, but also in his films. And now I show you a clip of about 9 minutes of a film that, to my knowledge, was not really made for a public projection. I don't know for which occasion this film was made. It's a film of half an hour that he has made about himself. It's a portrait of Werner Herzog by Werner Herzog, made in 1986. And I show you the beginning of the film because there he explains a lot about this village Sachrang, where he grew up. And about Bavaria.
Dies hier sind Aufnahmen vom Oktoberfest in München. Es ist meine Stadt, in der ich lebe und arbeite, wie die meisten Filmregisseure meines Landes. München hatte immer schon etwas Fantasievolles, Barockes, etwas Besonderes, das sie zu einer kulturellen Metropole in Deutschland gemacht hat. Die Feste werden hier in Bayern bunter gefeiert als anderswo in Deutschland. Die Eröffnung des Festes wird jährlich wie ein großer Staatsakt zelebriert. Der Bürgermeister der Stadt zapft das erste Bierfass an und für die Medien ist der Moment ein Ereignis wie die große Weltpolitik. Ich bin hier mit Freunden in einem der Bierzelte. Alle am Tisch haben mit vielen zu tun, als Produzenten, Autoren, als Festivalleiter. An schönen Tagen strömen hier über eine halbe Million Menschen zusammen. Aber ganz tief im Herzen bin ich jemand, der sich unter so vielen Menschen nicht wohlfühlt. Ich stamme aus einem einsamen Gebirgstal. Ich gehe sehr viel zu Fuß. Dazu trage ich meistens diese Gamaschen. Das ist im Grunde genommen gegen die Nässe weiter oben in den Bergen. Gepäck nehme ich sehr wenig mit, ein paar Pfund. Ich bin jemand, der sehr große Strecken zu Fuß geht. Von diesem Punkt aus bin ich vor 2 Jahren zu Fuß losgegangen. Und zwar liegt dieser Punkt hier genau an der Grenze von Deutschland zu Österreich. Das ist am Rande des Dorfes, in dem ich aufgewachsen bin. Die Grenze verläuft hier nach Westen. Und als Kind dachten wir Kinder, als Buben noch, wir müssten an der Grenze entlang gehen und würden dann, wie wenn man um die Welt herum geht, am selben Punkt nur aus der anderen Richtung wieder zurückkommen. Ich bin damals 2.000-3.000 Kilometer zu Fuß gegangen und weiß inzwischen natürlich sehr viel mehr über mein Land. Ein kleines bisschen hat auch die Vorstellung eine Rolle gespielt, dass dieses Land, aus dem ich stamme, ja ein zerteiltes und zerrissenes ist. Der Krieg hat unser Land in verschiedene Teile zerrissen. Und ein Mensch, der zu Fuß außen herum geht, immer der Grenze folgend, würde das Land auch irgendwie zusammenhalten. Manchmal sage ich ein bisschen zum Scherz, meine Filme sind alle Filme, die zu Fuß gemacht sind. Es stimmt, es ist etwas Richtiges daran, weil sehr viele entscheidende Dinge in meinem Leben habe ich zu Fuß gemacht. Ich bin beispielsweise einmal zu Fuß von München nach Paris im Winter gegangen. Das sind 800-900 Kilometer, weil eine Person, die für mich sehr, sehr wichtig war, im Sterben lag. Und ich dachte, wenn ich zu Fuß käme, würde sie gerettet sein. Das war etwas wie eine Pilgerfahrt fast. Und ich werde ganz sicher auch noch weiterhin sehr große Strecken zu Fuß gehen. Das ist eine ganz eigene Form von Leben und Existenz, das wir fast ganz aus unserem Leben, aus unserem normalen Leben verloren haben. Südlich der Alpen lebt auf dieser Burg ein Freund, der auch ein großer Zu-Fuß-Geher ist, ein Bergsteiger, vielleicht der größte Alpinist, den es derzeit gibt. Es ist Reinhold Messner und wir planen zusammen einen Spielfilm im Himalaya am zweithöchsten Berg der Erde. Reinhold, große Frage für mich, die nicht ganz lösbar ist, ist, wie weit bringen wir die Schauspieler Ralf Dinkinski? Der ist über 50.
Aber er ist noch gut in Form, er ist also in Form, schmal. Ja. Und ich glaube schon, dass er am Südpfeilerweg, also an dieser Route, das ist der Normalweg von 1954, ja, wo ich 79 hochgestiegen bin, da ist der Anfang ein bisschen steinschlaggefährlich und vor allem sind da andere Gruppen, da können wir nicht arbeiten.
Wo ist das? Das ist ein bisschen abstrakt.
Wir sollten links gehen, also über diesen Pfeiler, über diese Schneerippe, ja, könnte der Klaus Kinski vielleicht bis in diese Höhe kommen, wenn er einen, ja, guten Tag hat. Und das Team, wenn du gute junge Kameraleute hast und du selber, ihr kommt vielleicht herauf bis in diese Höhe, so dass man schon relativ.
By the way, this film they are talking about was never made, but he made later he made a film based on an idea by Reinhold Messner, which is called A Scream of Stone, and was not filmed in Asia but in South America on a very difficult mountain.
Relativ nah an den Gipfel herankommt und auch noch ganz oben filmen kann.
Aber Kamera auf dem Gipfel undenkbar.
Nein, das ist.
35 mm Kamera.
Das ist zu schwer. Also das würde ich nicht tun. Ich glaube, da kriegen wir auch nichts mehr heraus. Dann, ja, dann haben wir zwar vielleicht eine Kamera oben, aber kein einziges Bild oder kein scharfes Bild oder die Kamera mit dem Kameramann abgestürzt. Das ist es auch nicht wert. Vor allem ist es interessant, wenn hier ein Kamerateam hochsteigt, dann kann es so von 300-400 Meter Entfernung das parallel kletternde Team filmen. Das wirkt ja in der Wand viel stärker. Ich sehe vor, dass wir relativ viele Lager aufbauen,
ja,
und dass wir eine kleine Gruppe von Sherpas, von einheimischen Trägern uns verpflichten, die diese Lager dauernd versorgen. Das heißt, dass wir oben bleiben können, solange wir arbeiten wollen. Die bringen uns Essen, die bekochen uns auch. Mhm. Weil sonst haben wir keine Lust, um 4 Uhr früh da bei 30 Grad Kälte aus dem Schlafsack zu kriechen und ohne zu essen ins Freie zu gehen und zu arbeiten. Also wir müssen schon versorgt und bekocht werden von unten. Das muss ein eigenständiges Team machen. Mhm. Damit wir da oben arbeiten können, es geht ja nicht um die Besteigung des Berges, sondern du willst einen Film, ja, nach Hause bringen.
Vom K2 ist da noch was?
Vom K2 habe ich hinten sehr schöne Bilder, ja, also in diesem Teil. Das ist jetzt schon sehr hoch oben, also, ja, das ist auf 8000 Meter, das ist unser letztes Bilder. Mhm. Das ist eine flache Stelle, wo man gut bivakieren kann. Ja. Ja. Das sind alles Aufstiegsbilder vom K2. Mhm. Das ist das dritte Lager, wo man das erste Mal nach China hinein
sieht. Das ist jetzt schon China. Und das ist der Gletscher.
Das ist der Gletscher, über den wir hier reinkommen.
Und das ist natürlich gut, den von oben zu sehen. So von tiefer unten wirkt es nicht so gut.
Von oben wirkt er wie eine Autobahn.
Diese Berge sind die Landschaft meiner Kindheit. Auch wenn ich fast alle meine Filme, bis heute sind es 24, an entlegenen Plätzen der Welt gedreht habe, kehre ich hierher immer wieder zurück. Beim Gehen habe ich immer die intensivsten Momente der Fantasie, des Pläne-Schmiedens. Ich schreibe dann sehr viel, arbeite an Projekten, an Drehbüchern. Ich habe Lyrik veröffentlicht, Drehbücher und Prosatexte. In den letzten Jahren sind von mir 6 Bücher erschienen, darunter vom Gehen im Eis, das mir besonders wichtig ist. Es entstand während eines winterlichen Fußmarsches nach Paris. Und dies hier ist Lotte Eisner, die Person, wegen der ich zu Fuß ging, deren Sterben ich verhindern wollte. Sie musste 1933 aus Deutschland emigrieren und gründete mit Henri Langlois die Cinémathèque in Paris. Diese Aufnahmen entstanden kurze Zeit, bevor sie dann wirklich starb. You know that I rigorously and categorically forbade you to die about 8 years ago when I marched from Munich to Paris just to prevent. I did this pilgrimage, and I've said now, well, you've got the permission to die now. To explain a little bit, you have been somehow the consciousness of the new German cinema. We are a fatherless generation, somehow orphans, because the barbarism of the Third Reich has disrupted the continuity of filmmaking. There was a void, a gap of almost a quarter of a century, and you have bridged the gap for us to the great filmmaking in the 20s of the Expressionist epoch. And more important so, my feeling is that there was no legitimate German culture anymore, not in film or anywhere. And your authority and your declarations has given us legitimacy. And only that has opened us the gate to audiences outside of Germany.
Yes, I was very happy when I saw your first film. And
that of Schlöndorff, for example.
Schlöndorff.
The Junge Teiles.
Yes, I thought the Schlöndorff's film, well, that's French influence, and he had lived quite long in France. But when I saw your Sign of Life, I said, that's a real German film, and that's something for me. And I was very happy because I knew it was after a modern version of Achim von Arnim. And I liked always the romantic writers. And so I was very happy to see it, and all to Fritz Lang. Fritz, I'm so happy Germany gets good films again.
Lebenszeichen.
So. So in order to fully understand the vibrations coming from this socially and geographically oppressive region, Sachrang, where he grew up, which either breaks you or makes you even stronger, as in the case of Herzog, I spent 1 week of the winter in the winter of 2007-2008 in Sachrang, the house where Herzog lived in poverty with his mother and his brothers, situated in a quarter of the village called Berg. Mountain still exists. So the village he grew up is called Mountain. Only a few meters away of the house where he grew up is the ski jump on which young Werner discovered his enthusiasm for the sport, ski jumping. An enthusiasm that later led to his portrait of Walter Steiner in The Great Ecstasy of Woodcarver Steiner. It's a film from 1975. About at that time very famous Swiss ski jumper. So his enthusiasm led not only to this film, but also to his narcissistic demonstrations of ski jumping exercises in Harmony Korine's dogma film Julian Donkey Boy from 1999. And I show you a clip of this. This is a film in which Werner Herzog, who once a while works as an actor, plays the father in a very strange family, and in one sequence he tells his boys about his youth as a ski jumper.
Cigarette on the ground, just about like that, and a glass of water, and you just got to step on this glass, and you have to pick it up, you have to balance, and you have to pick it up with your mouth without falling. It's really, really a tough one.
If you do it?
No, I don't think I can do it anymore, but you should be able to do it. It's all balance.
Yeah, it's all balance. But if you speak to the postman of Sachrang, a guy of Herzog's generation who has lost his driver's license several times in his career, each time a blow which condemned him to use a bicycle to deliver the mail. If you speak to this man, you will understand that nobody in Sachrang remembers Herzog and his family. The star in Sachrang is not Ecstasy Werner, but it's Müllner Peter. Typical Bavarian nicknames consist of two words. The second indicates the Christian name, and the first describes a profession or another feature of the person's life. And the Müllner Peter was the nickname of the miller Peter Huber, born in 1766. Although it is quite unclear why, he had an extraordinary education for a miller, including musical skills and medical knowledge. In the 1970s, Karl Oskar Renner took the bequeathed stories about this folk figure as a basis for his romance, The Müllner Peter from Sachrang, which was shortly afterwards adapted for the screen, and then at great expense filmed for Bavarian television as a three-part series. This series became so popular among the Bavarians that the citizens of Sachrang decided to create a Müllner Peter museum, which eventually opened its gates in 2001. So in Renner's romance, the miller, Müller Peter, gains such exaggerated qualities, his pride and his will to defy the authorities and the established rules are so pronounced that it is almost impossible not to think of Herzog and his way of painting a public picture of himself as a self-educated person with magical powers, because Herzog, for example, always highlights that he is an autodidact. He went never to a film school, he did never study at a university, and that he portrays himself like a kind of genius. So, self-educated person with magical powers who enjoys doing things his own way and who is afraid of virtually nothing, because Werner Herzog is not afraid of any risk he would have to take to make a film. So even if Sachrang does not remember Herzog, by remembering the miller in the museum, the village actually celebrates a quasi-mythological personality with a very similar character. So coming out of Herzog's mouth, the distinction between being German and being Bavarian sounds quite radical. But federalism is constitutive for the German nation state, and especially the politicians of Bavaria have always acted as if they were representing a sovereign state. Today, apparently, because Bavaria is the largest and economically strongest, as well as the most religious and conservative of the German Bundesländer regions. For example, Pope Benedict XVI now actually comes from the village Marktl in Upper Bavaria, which is quite close to the place where Werner Herzog comes from. By declaring himself Bavarian, Herzog expresses the wish to be looked at as someone endowed with the typical Bavarian dichotomy of attributes such as traditional authoritarian versus individualist and anarchic. So I think this is typical for Bavaria, this dichotomy. They are at one side they are very traditional and authoritarian, and at the other side you find there are more individualist and anarchic persons than in all other regions in Germany. Munich, for example, the Bavarian capital, where Herzog was born in 1942 and where he returned in 1953, was not only the location of the famously failed coup d'etat in 1923, known as Hitler Putsch, and later the center of the National Socialist Movement with its party headquarters, known as the Brown House, but also the location of a partly successful communist and anarchic upheaval after the end of the First World War, the Münchner Räterepublik, as well as of the audacious deeds of the resistant movements, the White Rose, in the Nazi time. As from 1962, when Herzog started, so what I want to say by this is you had very right-wing activities in Munich and very left-wing, and also like peace movements or anarchic movements, you had both. As from 1962, when Herzog started his career as a filmmaker, the Schwabing riots, situated in the homonymous Bohemian district of Munich, were a key event of the German or even of the European youth revolt in the 60s. In the following years, almost every single young German filmmaker moved to Munich, which thus became the center of new German cinema in the 60s and 70s. In his self-portrait, Werner Herzog filmmaker, which we just have seen a clip from, he tells us, Munich always had something imaginative, something baroque, something special that made it a cultural metropolis in Germany. Events in Bavaria are more colorfully celebrated than anywhere else in Germany. And in the picture, we see Herzog surrounded by friends at the famous Oktoberfest, which is, together with the carnival in Cologne, the most visible pagan relic in the Catholic region of Germany. Something bacchanal, or with Herzog's words, something baroque or ecstatic, just like the Bavarian onion domes in the world of architecture. And like many of Herzog's characters, stories and images in the world of filmmaking. So this city of Munich, which has spawned so many personalities who represent the Bavarian soul, which is with its concurrence of extreme individualism and extreme traditionalism, like Karl Valentin or Gerhard Polt, who are both comedians and filmmakers likewise. So this city of Munich, according to Herzog on a DVD commentary track recorded about 10 years ago, this city does not exist anymore. Today, it's chic and empty without any meaning, he says. And this might be one of the reasons for his decision to leave the country in the early 1990s, or even one reason why he doesn't like Germany anymore. As well prepared as Herzog might have been for an adventurous life by his very origins, they were impediments for successfully coping with the mental state and the ruling zeitgeist of his generation in Germany, which in spite of the revolutionary attitude in the 60s, asked for a certain political correctness. Refusing to accept this, Herzog had to bear massive attacks, which were emotionally and ideologically loaded, to say the least, by critics and intellectuals, as well as by leftist activists, until his departure for the States. The charges ranged from exploitation of the defenseless, such as disabled persons and Indians, to aestheticization of the horror. Many commentators simply called him a fascist. At his last appearance at the Berlinale before 2010, when he appeared again, and the last appearance before at the Berlin Film Festival in 1992, when he presented his film Lessons of Darkness, he was bawled at from the auditorium and then spit at outside the building, an experience which I don't want to miss, as he declared years afterwards from his Californian exile. Already in 1979, on the occasion of a visit to Chicago, he had declared, "There's so much hatred there in Germany against my films that you probably wouldn't even believe it." In the same year, 1979, he told the magazine Der Spiegel in Germany, "I won't immigrate to Hollywood because I cannot leave my culture, my country, maybe yes." More than 30 years later, the same magazine quotes Herzog regarding his film Bad Lieutenant with the words, "I have never left my culture. No matter where I shoot, I always shoot Bavarian movies." I now would like to try to fathom why his origins could have helped Herzog to settle in Los Angeles, where, as Jörg Henschel wrote in the Süddeutsche Zeitung, nobody would have expected him to go. And I'm also going to briefly discuss a key film to understand his strategy of carrying Bavaria into each of his international films, which is Heart of Glass, where the landscape shots I've shown you this morning came from. So it was the Chicago Sun-Times critic Roger Ebert, who had already at that time a fan, invited Herzog to the already mentioned workshop in Chicago in 1979. And just as important as this man might have been for Herzog's American reputation as a star of the independent film world, his resurrection in the 2000s with the acclaimed documentary Grizzly Man must partly be ascribed to preliminary work done by directors like Errol Morris or Michael Moore, who have successfully implanted the so-called new documentary in the public consciousness. Moore and Morris, for whose first film Gates of Heaven in 1978, Herzog had organized a promotional party during which he ate his shoe, documented in Les Blancs documentary film Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe. So Moore and Morris thus work on the same front of staged documentarism as Herzog, a front which does not exist in Germany, I would argue, where documentary filmmaking is still executed with a more purist approach. And we will talk about that tomorrow when talking about Herzog's idea of the cinema vérité. Talking about fronts, it is exactly this attitude, the famous frontier spirit, which has helped Herzog to identify with America and to become integrated into California, where, and I quote Herzog, "everything that shook the world in the last half century has its seeds. Civil and homosexual rights, movements, computers, dreams produced by Hollywood, but also stupidities like New Age and the hippies," unquote. Herzog has proved his own frontier spirit throughout his career with his pretension of finding new images and with his will to take risks in order to find them. In one of his films, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, he portrays a guy who must be considered the role model for Herzog's proper integration. Dieter Dengler had left the Black Forest in the south of Germany as a teenager after the Second World War in order to become a pilot, and became a US war hero with his first mission. The ingredients of his success story, according to Herzog's films, were courage, positive thinking, as well as the ability to evaluate dangers with a cool head and to instinctively make the right decisions, which is nothing less than the recipe for frontier spirit. So even today, Herzog states in the featurette for Rescue Dawn, his own remake of his documentary Little Dieter. It's a fiction film remake of his documentary. And there he says, "even today when I don't know how to go on, I ask myself, what would Dieter do?" Well, this is a role model for him, this guy with this frontier spirit or so. It's a guy from southern Germany and not from California. Apart from the emigration to the US, Dieter and Werner have two important things in common. They are from the same generation which witnessed the war during childhood, and they both come from a mountainous and densely wooded region in southern Germany. The German mountains, for their part, have always been a frontier, not only a frontier on the way to the south, to Italy, but also a frontier in the sense of a place where man is confronted with nature and destiny. And therefore, it is not very daring to describe the genre of the mountain film as the German Western. The mountain film is a typical German film genre invented by Arnold Funk in the 1920s, which was replaced after the war by another typical German film genre, the Heimatfilm, shot at similar locations as the mountain films, but with a completely different intention, whereas the mountain film is about individual heroism in a transcendental landscape, the Heimatfilm is about the reconstitution of a nation in a picturesque landscape. Herzog's personal frontier spirit, his urge to walk long distances, as he's told us, to find new images and so on, can thus be understood as the consequence of an early will to overcome the mountains which surrounded the village where he grew up. And remember, he grew up in a quarter which is called Mountainburg itself. At least this is how the famous South Tyrolean alpinist Reinhold Messner, which we have seen in the film, in the mid-1980s, a close friend of Herzog's, understands this. At that time, the two of them, as you have seen in the film, were planning to make a mountain film together in the Himalaya, a project that was never realized. Instead, Herzog filmed later, as I've told you, Scream of Stone in South America. But the mountain film has always been one important part of German film culture, in which Herzog showed a particular interest. One of his favorite movies being, for example, Hans Steinhoff's Die Geierwalli from 1940s, a famous mountain film. So thus, it does not come as a surprise that he directed his own Heimat film, Heart of Glass, partly filmed in the region around Sachrang in the spirit of a mountain film. So let me make just three observations about Heart of Glass. The first concerns Herzog's handling of landscapes. The film starts with images taken in Bavaria I've shown you that the images with the clouds in time lapse, and this is a quote: the clouds in time lapse. No, not only from Steinhoff's film Geier Valley, this famous mountain film, but also from the first mountain film ever, The Mountain of Destiny by Arnold Fang from 1924. So Herzog quotes with this mode of directing landscape, he quotes the genre of the mountain film. And then in his film Heart of Glass, then his depiction of the landscape shifts to landscape filmed in Alaska, in the Yellowstone National Park, in Monument Valley, as well as at the Niagara Falls, that were the second type of images that I've shown you this morning, but blurred with a specifically designed optical technique in a way that they become landscapes of the mind. And on the DVD commentary, Herzog declares, "This is also Bavaria, only stylized Bavaria, hard to identify. Basically, it's the landscape of a Western movie." So second, his treatment of the actors in the film Heart of Glass corresponds to that of the landscapes. They are also blurred because Herzog in this film Heart of Glass hypnotized all the actors personally before shooting the film. They are all hypnotized and they talk very slowly and so on. So to me it seems as if with this film Heart of Glass he had searched and found a way at the same time express his love for Bavaria and distance himself from his roots. So it's a film about the place where he comes from, about his love for the mountain film and so on. At the same time, by this technique of blurring the characters he depicts by hypnotizing them and of blurring his beloved Bavarian landscapes with this technical effect and then paralleling them with landscape from Northern America, it seems that he distances himself at the same time from his roots, at the same time that he's telling how he loves them. So it's like a secret manifest of his working method, because although Herzog tends to display himself as an explorer, in his films he does not exactly come across as someone who tries to understand his discoveries, but as someone who is constantly looking for the same patterns in different environments. And these patterns come from his childhood in Bavaria. So this is a guy who is talking about new images all the time. He goes to every corner all around the world, but he is not exactly a discoverer. He was curious to find something new. But in fact, if you watch his film and if you listen to what he says about this film, it's all about finding patterns that he knows from his childhood in Bavaria and other parts of the world. And this is from the end of this film, Heart of Glass.
Ja, und dann brechen sie auf. Pathetisch und sinnlos. In einem viel zu kleinen Boot.
So, there is unfortunately no English versions, but he says, okay, they are... they are going away now, and it's in a very small boat, and it's very pathetic. So, Heart of Glass, have you seen, ends with the sequence shot on the Irish Skellig Rock Island, so not in Bavarian Island. And now I quote from his DVD commentary to that sequence. He says, "At the very end, a few people set off in a brittle barge, they row into the open ocean because they want to explore, they want to see where the world ends. I recognize myself as one of them. So needless to say, the direction, of course, of this people taking off from Ireland is the American continent. Thus, in Heart of Glass, Herzog not only declares his love for Bavaria and reveals his strategy of turning blurred memories into abstract patterns which can be found any place, any time, but he also announces, this is a film from 1976, with this last sequence he also announces his departure, his later departure for the United States. And this departure is staged as something at the same time heroic but also very tragic. So this as a short introduction in Herzog's origins as a Bavarian and how he deals with or how he tries to make a concept of this origin, of this Bavarianness. But I now want to talk a little bit about his films in a chronological order, just that you get an expression of his whole career, an impression of his whole career. And I have divided his career into three segments. The first is called Prelude, so this is these are the films until his breakthrough, I would say. And as you can see, what is very important is that he started out very, very young, 1962, with 20 years. And there is another myth that says that he stole the camera with which he made his first film from the film school in Munich, where he never went, only to steal the camera. And so this is the first films are short films. Game in the Sand is also very special because it's like his black album. Prince, the pop star, has a black album, so an album that was recorded but never published. And Game in the Sand is Herzog's black album because this is a film that was never never projected anywhere. He keeps it at home, and he says probably he will destroy it before he dies because for him something went wrong in this film. It's about children playing with a hen, I think, and I think during filming the children went wild and killed the hen or something like that, and he doesn't want to show it. So it's another secret of his career. And then other short films, so The Unprecedented Defense of the Fortress Deutschreuss and Last Words are also short films. These short films, those two, for example, were projected at the Oberhausen Short Film Festival, which is, I think, one of the famous short film festivals worldwide, and it's 50... more than 50 years old. It's a very old festival. And then comes Sign of Life. This is his first feature film. I told you this is the film that he shot on Crete. And this is also the film this old lady, Lotte Eisner, was talking about when she saw that film. She wrote immediately to Fritz Lang because she was friends with all these famous German directors from the 1920s. And she wrote him immediately, I've seen a film by a young German director, and I can tell you now we have good films again in Germany. But this was not his breakthrough, Signs of Life. He could make this feature film, by the way, because he had already very young wrote a script for it and won a prize. And with this prize money, he could make the film. And for the film, he won another prize in Germany. And with this prize, he could make then the following films. And It's interesting to note that he could start his career because he won the prize for a film script, because Herzog's film scripts of that time are something special. They don't contain dialogues, for example. They are not film scripts as if you have a manual for screenwriting today. Everything that is in that manual, Herzog didn't do. Yeah. He published his film scripts, and he published it because he thought of them as literature, of as something that is not only a tool for making a film, but something that is an art by itself, a script. So they are more writings in prose than a dialogue script. And yeah, then Precautions is another short film with typical Bavarian anarchic characters. And then The Flying Doctors of East Africa, I've already told you about this film, is for the Flying Doctors commission film in Africa. It's also a short film. So, and then his real career, I would say, starts, and I have called this part of the career Reproaches, because there was always the shadow, his career in Germany was always shadowed by fierce reproaches. And it started with, Even Dwarf Started Small. I've already told you a little bit about this film, which was shot in on the island of Lanzarote. And as I've told you, the film is, all the actors are dwarfs in the film. And so it's about an educational institution, and the inmates make a kind of revolution, but this revolution goes completely wild and fails in the end. And they rebel against the pressure at the institution, but when they are eventually free, when they have freed themselves, they are even worse than the ones that were making the rules before. And of course, you can imagine making such a film in the late 60s or 1970s. He didn't really make friends with the student movement at the time, because they thought that was a caricature of themselves. And he always said that this wasn't true, because he wasn't interested in politics or making political statements, overt political statements in films. But from this time, the left generation or the guys from the left didn't like Herzog at all. And there were also another image in this film is a little monkey that is crucified, and there is a religious procession, and the first guy is carrying a cross with this crucified monkey. Of course, the monkey is not really crucified, but this is the image. And of course, there were some reproaches against him for the misuse of Christian symbols and so on. And what one has to know already in this film is that Herzog likes very much to play with inversion. Yeah, it means that when he shows when he makes a film in which everyone is a dwarf, then he wants us to think about who the real dwarf is. Yeah, it means the dwarfs in the film, in reality, for him, are not dwarfs, but they are really large persons. The dwarfs are we who think of ourselves that we are normal. If he shows handicapped people, then it is to make yourself think, who is the real handicapped? Am I really normal and this guy is not normal, or is it the other way around? And this is, for example, the same way how he uses animals. He uses many, many animals in his films, and it's always, you know, with this background, with this inversion. who is the ape, who is the monkey, is this really a monkey, or maybe am I the monkey here, and who is the civilized person here, is this Indian civil, or am I civilized, or maybe this indigenous person, or this monkey, or whatever. And but there were very few people who understood this in the 1970s in Germany. And then there's Fata Morgana. We have talked about this film, and then Land of Silence and Darkness. It's a documentary about deaf, blind people who cannot hear and who cannot see. This is why it's called Land of Silence and Darkness. And then Handicapped Future is a short film also about handicapped children. So, both films are about handicapped persons, and as I've said, there were then a lot of reproaches that he would abuse of handicapped persons, and that he would exploit them and whatever. And if you look at the films, it's difficult to understand the reproaches, because it's very sensitive how he portrays these people, and it's I think with a great warmth that he looks at those people. And for example, the protagonist of Land of Silence and Darkness is a woman of maybe 56 years or so, who is deaf and blind, but who has it's a language. The way they communicate is they type a kind of code in the palm of the hands. That's how they can communicate. And he learned this language and communicated. And this lady, for example, became a friend of his, and so on. And and it's not himself who tells the story, but it's other people who tells it about him. So you can be quite sure he's very compassionate with these people. And so if you read those texts of the time who reproach him of exploiting these persons in his films, it's difficult to understand it. But then it went on. I mean, Aguirre, then maybe you have heard of this film, The Wrath of God. This was his first real success, and this was his international breakthrough. Interestingly, not at once. This film was screened first at the Cannes Film Festival without almost any reaction. And then later, I mean, maybe 2 years later, came into the cinemas in France, and then all of a sudden became a huge success, a critical success, and a success with the audience at the box office. And by this success in France, the film managed to get back into German cinemas, and so it started. And then The Enigma of Caspar Hauser, of course, which is a film about Caspar Hauser. You may know this figure of the 19th century. It's a real story. It happened in the 19th century in Germany, also in Bavaria. That was a guy, a child of, I don't know, maybe 16, 17 years, who was all of a sudden stood at the marketplace of a village with a note in his hand, and in this note there were only some sentences about this guy, but nothing who explained where he came from, and he couldn't walk properly and talk and so on. And so he was like a guy who was raised with wolves, or who had lived his first 15 years in a cave or something like this. And then this guy was educated and so on, and became quite a famous figure, and then he was murdered, and until his last day it was a secret where he really came from. And there were for example rumors that he was the son of a king, and nobody wanted him to become king, and so they put him in a cave, and then he escaped maybe or so. And there were a lot of rumors, and he made a film about this, The Enigma of Caspar Hauser, which also was a very huge success. And and here you can already see that this is a very important topic for him. People who have problems with the integration in the normal society, problems of communication and so on. And interestingly also, he cast this Kaspar Hauser, who was in reality, as I've said, maybe 16, 17 years, with a guy who was far over 30 years old. When you know that Herzog loves to have this authenticating effect of working with laymen, of casting real people instead of actors, then you ask yourself, okay, but is this very authentical, a 16-year-old played by a 30-something? But here, it's like it's always with Herzog. For him, it was more important that the guy, Bruno S., by the way, was the name of the guy, that he cast for this role, had a little bit of the same background as the real Kaspar Hauser, because he was also, he was the son of a prostitute and given away as a young child, and then during the Nazi time, and so it was hospitalized and was in educational camps and houses and so on, and he was mistreated all of his youth, and he had a very strange way of talking and of communicating. He was a very strange person, but very soulful and rich at the same time. And although this guy was very far too old for this role, he was the proper person, because he was exactly with his personality expressing something which maybe the original Kaspar Hauser had also inside him. So, and of course, with this film, reproaches were that he was exploiting this Bruno S., this poor guy who had already had a bad youth, and now this Herzog was exploiting him for his films and so on. And the reality was that Bruno S. enjoyed very much filming, and by being a star in a fiction film, he also got a very good reputation at his work, where he worked in a fabric with his colleagues and so on, because now he was not a stupid Bruno anymore, but a real film star, and it, so it helped him in his real life. Also, he got some money and could buy something for his home and so on. And so these reproaches were a bit pointless, but still they were made, and this became the public image of Herzog in Germany, the guy who is exploiting anybody for his films. And also the German critics were very angry because these films, Aguirre and Kaspar Hauser, who made Herzog internationally famous, they were praised by French critics. So it was the French critics who revealed the genius of Herzog, not the German critics. And for the German critics, that was always a problem, and they reproached him of filming the critics that he got for his former films in France. So if the French would write a nice critic for a film, Herzog would take these praises and make a film out of it, only to please the French the more, and so on. So, I mean, that was not his fault that the French first wrote that his films were great, but the Germans didn't like him because of that. So then, No One Will Play With Me is another short film about children. How Much Wood Would a Woodchuck Chuck? Another short film about it's not important. Heart of Glass is the film I was talking about. It's this film that was shot in Bavaria, in the region where he grew up, and with that finish, who kind of foresees his own um, his own emigration to the United States. And then La Soufrière, it's a film shot on the island of Guadeloupe. It's quite interesting because there is a volcano on the island, and at one point the whole island had to be all the people had to be evacuated because it seemed that the volcano would explode. And at exactly this point, Herzog with two cameramen went to the island to film, because he had read in the newspaper that one shepherd had refused to be evacuated. He wanted to stay on the island, and he wanted to talk to this man. So he went to the island, although the volcano could explode any minute, and he went to the volcano and filmed it and waited for the explosion and so on. And at the end, eventually, the volcano never exploded, and so Herzog could continue to live and make other films. And Strošek then is, so Strošek is the name of the protagonist in his first film, Signs of Life, and then he made another film where the protagonist is called Strošek again. So the protagonist in this film is called Bruno Strošek, and he is played by Bruno S., the same actor as in the Kaspar Hauser film. And it's a very interesting film because it's more or less a film. Half of the film is about Bruno S. It's a fiction film with Bruno S., but it's at the same time a little bit of a documentary about Bruno S. And his life in Berlin. But in the second part of the film, Bruno S. emigrates to the United States, and he never emigrated to the United States in reality. Then it becomes real fictional, and it I would say the second part then is not anymore about Bruno S., it's more about Herzog himself, because like in Heart of Glass 1 year earlier, he already fantasized about this immigration from Bavaria to the States, and here again, and in the 70s indeed, he himself was invited many times to American festivals and became very, very famous among film critics, and very beloved among film critics in the United States. So half of it is about this Bruno, and the other half is about himself. This film was one of the few films that the German film critics generally liked. And then comes Nosferatu, which is a remake, as I've said, of the Murnau film from the 1920s, and it's interesting because even here there were huge reproaches against him, and this time the reproach was that he was abusing of high culture in the sense that so he was desecrating, like profaning high culture, because this original film from the 1920s belongs to, you know, the German film heritage, and this guy makes a remake, and it's a totality, it's a total desecration, because of course Herzog's film can never be as good as the original. And so the, at this that I mean, that means that already at this time the critics were used to make reproaches to Herzog, so that with every new film they would invent new reproaches, even if would be hard to find some. And so for the Wojciech, the next film, it's exactly the same, because this is a film based on a theater play by Georg Büchner, which is a famous German writer of the 19th century, and in the reviews you find exactly the same arguments, you know, that it's a profanation of high culture. And in fact, this film, or another reproach was, because the film is based on a theater play, that this film was too theatrical, which is also completely nonsense, because this is really a very interesting film in the way that he adapts this theater play, because he works with very, very, very few shots. He holds the shots very long, and you could call that theatrical, having very long-lasting shots with dialogue. But if you watch carefully, it's very intelligent how he stages the camera and what happens in front of the camera and how he moves the camera in these long-lasting shots. It's very elaborate, and it's also oriented very much to pictures from the 19th to paintings from the 19th century. So it has not only to do with theater, it also has to do with film and also with paintings, for example. Okay. Then, by the way, Wojciech and Nosferatu are, of course, two of the films that he has shot with Klaus Kinski. So with this famous crazy actor, the first was Aguirre, so the film he got international reputation. With Kinski, then Nosferatu and Wojciech, later Fitzcarraldo, which was maybe the culmination point, and Cobra Verde was the last film with Klaus Kinski. Five films, and until today in Germany, Werner Herzog is mainly seen as the crazy guy who shot five films with the other crazy guy. So this is mainly how they see Werner Herzog. So, and then already after Wojciech, he went into production for Fitzcarraldo, because the production lasted really 3 years. And these films, and while working on Fitzcarraldo, and they had problems with everything, money and so on, and he was not staying the whole time in the jungle for all the 3 years. Sometimes he went, for example, to the United States to look for new money or to get new ideas, and he would then mostly stay in the house of Francis Ford Coppola, who was already then a close friend. And if you look at Apocalypse Now, you can clearly see the influence of a film like Aguirre or Fitzcarraldo, also shot in the jungle, on Coppola. Coppola was a huge fan of Herzog's films. And and while then during the shooting of Fitzcarraldo, staying in sometimes in Los Angeles or also New York, he made two short films, God's Angry Young Man in LA and New Sermon in New York, and they are about ecstatic priests. God's Angry Man is about a television priest, and Wee Sermon is about a Baptist priest. Yeah, then Where the Greed Ends Dream. It's a film shot in Australia, also with indigenous people, with Aborigines. It's a film a little bit in the mood of the Green Movement, and at that time, in the 1980s, the Green Party became really strong in Germany. And as you maybe know, it's today the Green Party. I think there's no other country where the Green Party is as strong as in Germany. They've already been part of the national government for quite a while and are in many, many regional parliaments. They're a very strong party, and that started in the 1980s, and this film seems to be a little bit in the zeitgeist of this Green Movement. And Ballad of the Little Soldier is a film shot in Nicaragua and border to Honduras, and that was the time of the Sandinists, so the national movement which fought also against the Americans and the CIA, who paid agents in Nicaragua. It was a political fight. And the thing about this film, it's very interesting, because Herzog in this film is interested into children soldiers, and but by portraying these children soldiers, he also has to say some negative things about the Sandinists, which were the local revolutionaries, and because of that he was massively attacked, especially in Germany, from the left, because he said negative things about the Sandinists, and they immediately named him a CIA agent and so on, and which is absolutely, completely nonsense. But that's how it went. So that is also typical. It's like with the dwarf film. If you look at the film, becomes clear he didn't want to make a political statement with this film in the sense of taking sides with the Sandinists or with the CIA or so, but he wanted to make a political film in the sense that he was portraying children soldiers and accusing more or less idea of making children into soldiers. But unwillingly, the film was only seen as a political statement. Yeah? In the critiques in which he is attacked as a CIA agent, nobody, not one word about the children soldiers. You know, it was completely irrelevant for his critics. It's very interesting. You can study in the case of Herzog that when at one point, you know, the public opinion has taken sides or has formed an image of someone, it's really almost impossible to get out, you know. He could do what he wanted, it was always the same kind of attack, and the people were blind for all the other aspects. And so The Dark Low of the Mountains then is a film about this mountaineer, Reinhold Messner, who is really one of the world's most famous mountaineers because he was the first on many, many of the 8,000 meter mountains and so on and so on. And so it's a film about this guy, and we have seen both of them in this portrait film. And Reinhold Messner is not only, I mean, now he's old, but he was not only a great mountaineer, but he was also a very good media person. He was very apt in selling his personality. So after having been on the mountain, he would come back and you know, go into talk shows and write books and sell himself and sell his deeds. And so he got the money for buying, you saw this castle where he kind of lived. Yeah, he bought it. I mean, where did the money come from? Of course, because he could sell himself so well. And so when Herzog did this portrait of him, he portrayed him not at this castle at home, but in the mountains somewhere in Asia, where Messner with a colleague did something very special, because they not only went to the peak of an 8,000 meters mountain, but they went to the peak of one and went down and went directly to the next peak, also over 8,000 meters, and then come back. So all in one day or in 2 days, but in one action. And I think that was before nobody had achieved something like this. So, and it's interesting in this film because those two guys come back after these 2 days. And I mean, you just look at them and you see, okay, they are really tired, and I mean really tired, you know, because that is really exhausting. They almost died at this trip. Yeah. And what does Herzog? He takes this guy Messner in a tent and wakes him up and asks him, like, okay, now tell me, how was that 20 years ago when you lost your brother in the mountains, your brother had died and you went home and you had to tell it to your mother. How was that? Tell me about it. And of course, Messner starts to cry and so on. And one has to know that this is a major history of Reinhold Messner. This is when he was young, he and his brother, they were both very good mountaineers. And when they were very young, early 20s or so, his brother died on a trip, and until recently, Reinhold Messner always stated, okay, I have searched for him as long as I could, but he was gone, I didn't find him, and I couldn't help him. And many other people reproached him, no, you only wanted to go to the peak yourself, and you didn't care about your brother at all. And now, only 2 or 3 years ago, finally, one has found some bones that clearly they are identified belong to his brother, and by the location where they were found and so on, it is now almost clear that Reinhold Messner is right about his version of the story. But still, at the time when it was filmed, it was still really a public affair. Did this guy more or less kill his brother or not? So this is the background of this question. And Herzog then says, when speaking about this scene, you know, cinema is merciless, the camera is merciless. So if you want to, and this Reinhold Messner is such a media person, you know, I wanted to go to get another truth, not this superficial media truth. I want to go inside him with the merciless camera. And this is very typical for him in trying to get something true and real out of the people. And of course, then even there, people of course reproach him. Yeah, he was abusing this media guy, this mountaineer, and so on. Then Cobra Verde, it's the last film with Kinski, also there with filmed in Africa with indigenous, again reproaches and so on, always the same thing. And then what happened after or when he stopped to make films with Kinski, he fell mostly into oblivion, also because this Fitzcarraldo affair, because there was a huge affair, there was even, because he was accused of killing people there and whatever, and then Amnesty International went there and looked after the facts, and then they published a report that Herzog had done nothing wrong, but nobody cared about it. The report just went on and on and so on. And this had a huge effect, I think, even huger effect than all the other reproaches on his public image. And even in countries like the United States and so, where he was also quite famous before, people kind of stepped away from him. And so he fell a little bit into oblivion. And also at the time then he stopped making feature films. He still made some feature films, but less than before, and more went into the documentary filmmaking. And of course, with documentaries, it's more difficult to get famous. And you see, for example, Vodabe is also filmed in Africa. Echoes from a Somber Empire, we will see a clip of this film. It's about Jean Bidel Bokassa, who made himself emperor of Central Africa and who killed many, many people there. Also, in the terms of Herzog, a very ecstatic character. And then it's misspelled Scream of Stone, of course. It's this mountain film, but not filmed in Asia, but in South America. This is, by the way, Scream of Stone was the first film that Herzog made that was not based on a script that he has written himself. And it's very odd. It's also, I would say, his only fiction film that is very bad in terms of storytelling. So maybe it was a better idea to write his script of his own. The second film, by the way, that was based on a script written by someone else was then Bad Lieutenant, only 2 or 3 years ago. So the only fiction films that were not based on his own scripts. And so this Eccentric Bayreuth Theater, this is a film that he made for André Heller, which is an Austrian artist that stages shows, and it's a show staged in India. It's not very interesting, I think. Film Lesson is also, I've never seen it. It's difficult to see, but it seems that it was shot during the Vienna Film Festival, that it's a film in which he tries to explain his ideas of film school. And then comes the famous Lessons in Darkness. We will talk about that tomorrow. There the reproaches concerned aesthetization of the cruel or whatever, aesthetization of the horror. But we will talk about it tomorrow. By the way, I've not pointed out that throughout the 80s, when he was accused, people called him always a fascist. I mean, I think that was popular in the 1980s. If you didn't like somebody, at least in Germany, you called him a fascist or so. And Herzog was a fascist for almost everybody. And it was even in academic publishing, people compared him to Joseph Goebbels and to whatever. And it's, if you read it today, and you know some of these scholars who wrote it are still active. One is a Harvard professor, for example, and he, in one article, compares Herzog, you know, pages after pages with Goebbels and Hitler and Riefenstahl and all fascists and the steely romanticism, I don't know what. And you read it today and you think, so it's, how is that possible that such intelligent, bright public academic figure? But it was, I don't know, it was kind of the zeitgeist, obviously, to call people fascists and to make reproaches to von Herzog. Bells from the Deep, we will also see a clip from that film, is about, how do you call it? You have faith, and if your faith doesn't concern an official religion, but it's more based on myths than it's heresy. I don't mean heresy, but it's okay, I will find the word later. We will talk about that film tomorrow, so I will look up the word and tell you what I mean. So then the transformation of the world into music is about opera, because at that stage of his career he started to direct opera. And he got also kind of famous for that. He staged a lot of operas, and this film is about staging operas in Bayreuth, so in the famous Wagner place. And Death for Five Voices is about an Italian composer from the 17th century called Gesualdo, who was way ahead of his time with his music, and who is also a person full of myths and great eccentric person, and there are a lot of legends for him. And this is also a film by Herzog where he mixes myths and legends and facts. Little Dieter Needs to Fly, I've already talked about. I will also continue to talk about that film tomorrow. My Best Fiend, of course, is about his films with Kinski, and this was the only Herzog film that became very popular in Germany, and that is very telling, because in Germany, people only like Herzog when he does something with Kinski, because people like Kinski in Germany. Or if they don't like him, they hate him, but it's also a reason to go to the cinema. And so this film was the only really box office success in Germany that Herzog had, My Best Fiend. And of course, there were then also reproaches that he was exploiting Kinski in this film, because he was telling his version of the story with Kinski, but Kinski has died some years before, so he couldn't tell his own own version. So people reproached him for exploiting Kinski. And then The Lord and the Lady, and this is about pilgrimage, as well as the film Pilgrimage itself. Wings of Hope is a film that is similar to Little Dieter Needs to Fly, because Little Dieter Needs to Fly is about this guy who was raised in Germany and then went to the US and became a pilot, and was shut down in his first flight in the Vietnam War after 40 minutes, and became a prisoner of war in the jungle, and he was, I think, the only American prisoner of war in the Vietnam War who managed to escape from a prison camp, and he almost died then in the jungle and was almost dead, was then found by other American soldiers, and he became one of the hugest war heroes in America. And this film is about his story. But what Herzog is interested in is his escape, because how he survived alone without anything, barefoot in the jungle, this is what Herzog interests. And Wings of Hope is about a woman that survived a plane crash. A plane crashed into the jungle in Peru. Everybody was dead. Only this woman, who then was a girl of 17 years, she found herself alive without any problems in the jungle. Everybody around her was dead. And she managed for 2 weeks to find a way through the jungle to a civilized era. And in both film, Herzog takes these people back to these places for the first time. They have never been back there to retell the story. And then Invincible, I've told you, is about this Jewish strongman. And then Wheel of Time is about Buddhism and also about pilgrimage. And The White Diamond is one of the films that I gave you to see. It's about flying. Grizzly Man, I hope you've seen that one. I think it's the strongest film Herzog has ever made. It's about this bear guy. I told you about it. And Grizzly Man, of course, as I've told you, was a huge success in the US and not in Germany. It was not even shown in the cinema in Germany. Nobody knows the film in Germany. In the US, everybody knows it. And Wild Blue Yonder is the other film. We have already seen a clip. But Rescue Dawn is the remake of this Little Dieter Needs to Fly. There, Christian Bale is Little Dieter. And Encounters at the End of the World was nominated for a documentary Oscar. Is the film made at the South Pole. And that was Oblivion, because these films, also the last of them, were famous or are famous and are very well known in the United States and also in France again, or in Italy. In Germany, not. He's still in Oblivion. And then maybe this started to change with Bad Lieutenant, because at the same time Herzog was the leader of the president of the jury at the Berlin Festival, and gave his bequest, his things, his immortal bequest to the archive and so on. But Bad Lieutenant was also not successful in the cinema. La Bohème is a short film. My Son, My Son, What Have You Done was not in the cinemas in Germany. It's a film with Willem Dafoe. And then Cave of Forgotten Dreams, I mean, one of the first 3D documentaries, was shown at the Berlin Film Festival. And I think with this film, now also a new generation of the German audience may get another image, a fresh image of Herzog and his work, and maybe discover also his older works without this ideological view. Into the Abyss and Death Row, I've not seen them. They were screened this year at the Berlin Festival. It's about Death Row, about death candidates in US prisons. So, but I think time is over, and we will continue tomorrow. Thank you.